Hello, and welcome to Such a Fun Read, a podcast where we come together to read a book and chat about it, like a book club. I'm your host and resident reader, Cherie, and I am really excited to dive in and continue our discussion about the book we are currently reading, A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. We'll be getting into the characters, the story, the lore, and unraveling how this series all begins. This podcast is not spoiler-free, but we will not be discussing anything that happens in future books in this series, and we will only be discussing what we've read so far. We'll start out with the manuscript section. There we will talk about what just happened. What we just read, we will go chapter by chapter. And then we will go to the congregation section. Here we will talk about the things that stood out in the chapters, things we learn about, things we might think will be important for later, and we also might talk a little bit about lore here as well. And then we will have a rapid fire section. Here we'll go over three characters I want to talk about, two things I'm looking forward to, what moments have intrigued me about what could happen in the future, and one favorite quote. I'll pick a favorite quote from these chapters. For this episode, we are discussing chapters 12 through 16. So whether you're a diehard fan of this series or discovering it for the very first time, there is something here for all of us to enjoy and explore together. Also, if you are enjoying these discussions about A Discovery of Witches, please head on over to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app and rate and review Such a Fun Read. It definitely helps spread the word and allows more fans of this book that we're reading to join our discussions and the community. Now, with all that being said, let's go ahead and get into the manuscript section and talk about what happened in these chapters. Chapter 12 starts out with Diana preparing dinner for Matthew. She had been trying to figure out what to cook for him all day. She was relieved that she was able to avoid run-ins with Peter Knox and Jillian Chamberlain earlier that day in the library, and she'd be able to focus on the dinner. But when Matthew arrives to her rooms, Diana feels a flutter of nerves, but quickly dismisses them. "I think we can call it a date, Diana. I think it's okay." At first, when Matthew arrives, he just stands at the door. Diana invites him in and makes a comment inviting vampires in her home. Matthew responds to her and tells her to forget what she thinks she knows about vampires. During the evening, Diana watched Matthew while he assessed his wine and wondered how many sensory receptors a vampire had in their nose. She also admitted to herself that she didn't know the first thing about vampires. Maybe that will change, Diana. Maybe that will change. As they share a meal, they talked and vampires came up. Diana also wanted to know if Matthew can really eat the smoked salmon, and he said yes, and he happens to like smoked salmon. But he also admitted that he only takes small bites of most food, and it doesn't taste like much to him unless it is raw. They continue to talk about the eating habits of vampires and other things about vampires. We learn that Matthew invited Diana out to eat so often because it's easier to be around her when she's eating. Cooked food nauseated him, and as long as he's nauseated, he isn't hungry. So they continue their discussion and talk about the differences between humans, vampires, witches, and demons. In a candid moment, Diana dares to ask Matthew what she smelled like, prompting a thoughtful pause from Matthew. He does give his answer, though. Matthew then thanked Diana because it had been a very long time since someone had made a meal for him. He brought over a wine for them to have for after dinner, and it was from 1811. The conversation then turned to Matthew's age. He first answered that he was older than he looked. Finally, after being hesitant about it, he gave her an answer. More on that later. So Diana asked him what he was doing in the fall of 1859, and Matthew wants to know what Peter Knox had been telling her. Matthew tells Diana what vampires believe about Ashmole 72, and Diana tells Matthew what she knows about the book. Before Matthew left, he invited Diana to his lab the next day. He wanted to show her something. And as he was at her door, Matthew noticed something off about the lock on her door and told Diana she should have it checked. Before Diana could stop herself, she ends up giving Matthew a spontaneous kiss on the cheek that caught them both off guard. We move on to chapter 13, and it is the next day, and Diana is off to Matthew's lab. She noticed there was a lot of security to get into said lab. Matthew eagerly shares his latest research with Diana, delving into the genetics of vampires, witches, and demons. The lab buzzes with activity as Marcus Whitmore joins them. We meet Marcus. His keen eye caught Diana's AB negative blood type and her witch heritage. But then Miriam shows up, and she sheds some light on Matthew's revelations about Ashmole 782. Together, they looked over newspaper clippings, revealing a grim truth. Vampires are facing extinction from botched attempts to transform humans into vampires. And in the midst of it all, DNA sequences reveal a startling revelation about witch ancestry. Magic has been suppressed through generations. With a sense of urgency, Diana offers up her blood, hoping to unlock her own history and shed light on the witch's plight. Then before anyone else can take Diana's blood, Matthew insists on collecting the sample himself, which continued to show his protectiveness over Diana. As they wrap up their time in the lab, they end up going to another yoga session, which is followed by a walk back to Diana's rooms. Then Matthew extends another dinner invitation for the next evening to Diana. It was his turn after all, and it was met with eager acceptance from Diana. When Diana got to her rooms, she ignored another message from her aunt, Sarah, and she watched Matthew leave from her window. On to chapter 14. As they made their way to dinner, Matthew collected Diana, and together they walked off to his rooms, which was nestled within the prestigious All Souls College at Oxford. And in a secluded corner of the building, Matthew led her to his private cellar, which was a privilege bestowed upon select fellows. They talked about when he came to Oxford, 1989, when he was at Oriel College. He made sure to say this time in referring when he came to Oxford. Then he talks about the amount of times he's been at certain colleges in Oxford. Diana and Matthew conversed throughout the dinner, and Diana ate while Matthew drank wine. Things seemed to be going fine. Yet when Diana wondered what she might taste like, Matthew's demeanor shifted. His protective instincts flared as he cautioned her about the dangers of bewitching vampires. And in a moment of vulnerability, their lips met in a tender kiss, only for Matthew to pull away. He started to apologize for taking advantage of Diana's fear. He also told her to stay still as he might not be able to control himself. And of course, Diana says that she was safe with him. Matthew started to say that he was experiencing emotions he wasn't supposed to feel before he cut himself off. He said that a witch and a vampire aren't supposed to feel this way, and Diana said she felt it too. Then their conversation turned to how vampires needed to manage impulses, and Diana brought up how witches needed to as well. Diana doesn't want to look back on a life where everything came easily to her without earning it. Then Diana told him that she was going to recall Ashmole 782 on Monday. Matthew wondered what spell she used to get it the first time around, and Diana said she didn't use one, which confused Matthew. And now Matthew was nervous that if Peter Knox or the others found out she didn't use the spell to get it, they would stop being patient with her. And at the end of the chapter, we learn that it doesn't bother Diana that Matthew goes hunting. Sometimes she eats partridge. She doesn't see the difference. On to chapter 15. We are on to Monday. Diana went rowing that morning, and when she was done, Matthew was there waiting for her. They go for breakfast at the cafe he took her to before, and then Matthew drops her off back at her rooms. Then we are back to the Bodleian. It is time for Diana to try to get Ashmole 782 again. We see her friend Sean again. He is back at the call desk. Matthew is already at the Bodleian when Diana gets there. She went up to him and asked if Peter Knox was already there as well, and Matthew said he was. Diana went to the call desk and got her requested manuscripts and then gave Sean a new request, Ashmole 782. Their conversation wasn't over, though. Sean wanted to speak with Diana. He wondered if Professor Claremont was bothering her. She, of course, said he wasn't. He then told Diana that he wanted her to let him know if something was ever wrong, and she said that she would. After dealing with sweet Sean, we deal with annoying Peter Knox. He once again barged in, disrupting Diana's day. Despite her attempts to brush him off, he persisted, trying to manipulate her thoughts again. Matthew stepped in, being a protective presence by her side, as Knox continued his intrusive behavior, threatening Diana with accusations. He told her that before nightfall, every witch in Oxford would know that she was a traitor. Feeling uneasy, Matthew expressed his desire to leave, emphasizing that he didn't need the manuscript, and he almost admitted how he needed Diana. This man, or vampire, just continues to stop himself from expressing his real feelings. We then briefly meet a new demon, the one that has been around who loves coffee. He greeted both Diana and Matthew. His name was Timothy, and he wore different color cowboy boots, one red and one black. His eyes were different colors as well, one blue and one green. Diana's impatience grew regarding her wait for Ashmole 782, and she went back to the call desk to ask about the manuscript that she requested, and she was met with alarming news. She was told Ashmole 782 has been missing since 1859. Matthew then decided they needed to leave the library. They noticed the other creatures seemed to need to leave in a hurry as well. Before they could make their exit, though, Peter Knox intercepted Diana once more, throwing insults and more warnings her way. Apparently, she would regret it if she didn't remember who she was. Matthew intervened and they leave before he could cause a scene, and they go back to Matthew's rooms. He starts urging her to stay at Woodstock, the old lodge, where they go for yoga, for safety. Then Diana ends up turning on Matthew, and she said that he's as bad as Knox. He wanted Ashmole 782 to satisfy his own curiosity. Matthew tells her to calm down, and that does not go over well. Her fingers start to shoot out little arcs of fire again. Diana then tries to run away, and Matthew won't let her. He holds onto her tight. She told him to let her go, and he said no. He is the first man to ever say no to her when she asks them to stop doing something. He wondered if that happened before with her fingers, and she said that it happened once, after speaking with Jillian Chamberlain. Reluctantly, Diana agreed to go to Woodstock, the old lodge, and Matthew takes her back to her rooms to pack. Before heading off to her rooms, she picked up her mail, and there was a large brown envelope. When she opened it, she found a photo of her parents in the chalk circle when they died, and a piece of paper attached to the photo that said, "Remember?" She screamed, and Matthew was at her rooms in no time. Overwhelmed, Diana confided in Matthew about Jillian's revelation regarding her parents' death. Witches killed her parents. He offered her comfort, administering a sedative and assuring her she wasn't alone anymore. Chapter 16, we are back in Matthew's perspective. He sat by Diana's side as she slept. He listened to his messages, and there was a message from Marcus that caught his attention, hinting at surprising revelations in Diana's DNA test results. Without hesitation, Matthew called Marcus and instructed him to bring the reports in his passport to Diana's rooms. He gave him directions, of course. Marcus had never been there. As Marcus arrived, he casually referred to Matthew as his father. We get backstory on when Matthew and Marcus met and also learned when Marcus was turned. That would be in 1781. So Matthew thought that Marcus made a mistake about Diana's DNA test. Apparently, Diana possessed nearly every genetic marker ever seen in a witch. There were DNA sequences that had Marcus and Miriam concerned. Marcus then noticed the necklace around Matthew's neck, and then he thinks about a woman named Eleanor St. Leger and the year 1140. More of Matthew's family is mentioned, his father Philippe and his older brothers Hugh, Godfrey, and Baldwin. Then Matthew wanted Marcus to stay with Diana for a while. He planned on confronting Jillian Chamberlain and then possibly Peter Knox. However, Marcus mentioned how Peter was a part of the congregation, and he cautioned Matthew against further antagonizing them, highlighting Matthew's situation with Diana and bringing up the covenant. Marcus then agreed to look after Diana, and once Matthew returned, Marcus wondered if Matthew would share the DNA findings with Diana, and he said no. I don't think Diana is going to like that. Marcus didn't think so either. Then Marcus also wondered if Diana knew about their family or Matthew's other children. Of course, that was a no, and Marcus said that Matthew was making a mistake. Matthew said he would tell her everything when she was ready. Also, the plan shifted. Matthew announced his decision to take Diana to Septor and not Woodstock Lodge. Marcus then voiced his concerns. He said that Matthew can't put her under the same roof as Isabeau, Matthew's mother. It seemed that Isabeau blamed witches for the death of Louisa and Philippe, Matthew's father. But despite the objections, Matthew remained steadfast in his determination to protect Diana at all costs. Alone with Diana once more after Marcus was gone, Matthew grappled with his inner thoughts. He wondered if he was bewitched and if he was a lost man. Diana said, "You're not lost. I found you." But she was still out of it. She seemed to be able to hear his thoughts in those moments. Let's move on to the congregation section, where we will talk about the things that stood out in these chapters, things we learned about, and things we might think will be important for later, as well as some lore. Since we call this section the congregation, let's start off by talking about what it is. Here is what we know about the congregation so far. The congregation consists of 9 members, 3 vampires, 3 witches, and 3 demons. It was formed during the Crusades, and its job was to ensure every creature's safety by seeing to it that no one caught the attention of humans. We know that Peter Knox is a member, and that's about it. That was the first time the congregation was mentioned in this book. But there's another thing that was brought up as well. Something that was set up by the congregation, and that was the covenant. This was a series of restrictions. All creatures, past and future, vampires, witches, and demons alike, entered into a pact to adhere to the rules of conduct set forth by the congregation. One of those rules was forbidding mixing between creatures. They were strongly discouraged to socialize with other creatures and were forbidden to fall in love and marry. Now, since there were only 9 members, they pretty much needed snitches. They needed creatures to snitch on their own kind or other creatures. Matthew does mention how the covenant was so long ago, and he said the congregation isn't going to enforce a promise made over 1,000 years ago in a very different world. I get what Matthew is saying, but the fact that Peter Knox is on the congregation and his behavior towards Diana and Matthew's relationship, I think Matthew might be naive about this situation. Another thing we can talk about here is Matthew Claremont. We have learned more about him. Let's discuss. We actually got his age. His body is nearly 37 years old, and he was born around the time Clovis converted to Christianity. He was reborn a vampire in 537. So this man, or vampire, is close to 1,500 years old. We also find out what Matthew was doing in the fall of 1859. Peter Knox told Diana to ask Matthew what he was doing then. And in September of 1859, Matthew was looking through the manuscripts in the Ashmolean Museum. He had recently read On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. Matthew saw how Darwin explored alchemical theory of transmutation through biology, and then he remembered the mysterious book, Ashmole 782. He was in Oxford looking for Ashmole 782 in 1859. We also learned that Matthew was around when chocolate was first introduced in France. And another thing we can bring back from previous episodes are the women that Matthew harmed. There was a mention by Marcus of a woman named Eleanor, and she was one of them. She was a woman that had gotten in between Matthew and Baldwin when they were fighting, and she died. Marcus did wonder about her, and he also wondered why Matthew let Eleanor die if he loved her so much. Why didn't he turn her? Some other interesting moments were Diana asking about her smell versus how she would taste. So while they were having dinner, Diana asked Matthew what she smelled like. Matthew took a moment to answer, but then he said she smelled like willow sap and chamomile that had been crushed underfoot. And he goes on to say that she smelled like honeysuckle, fallen leaves, witch hazel blooming, the first narcissus of spring, whorehound, frankincense, and lady's mantle. Some of those scents he thought he had forgotten. But the next dinner, when Diana wondered what she tastes like, things did not go as easily. Matthew's demeanor changed, and he warned Diana about a vampire being bewitched by a woman and not being able to help themselves. We learned that Diana's scent pleases Matthew, and he can hear her witch's blood as it moves through her veins. So the moral of the story here is never ask a vampire what you might taste like. Or maybe it's don't even think about being around vampires, but to each their own. We also learn more about vampires in these chapters. So first, with their eating habits. While they were eating together at Diana's place, they talk about what a vampire can eat. Matthew admitted that he only takes small bites of most food, and it doesn't taste like much to him unless it is raw. He also said that wine is good, but food tastes wrong to a vampire once it's been cooked to death. And he prefers to eat food that is uncooked or cold so it doesn't smell. We also learned that it's easier for him to be around Diana when she's eating. The smell of cooked food nauseates him, and that helps for him to not want to eat her. Here are some other stuff that we learn. Vampires do have exceptional sense of smell, sight, and hearing. Scent brings out powerful memories for vampires. Vampires can't fly. Matthew said they leave that to the witches since they control the elements. They are strong and fast. They don't breathe much. Vampires don't sleep much, but when they do, they sleep like the dead. Marcus said that vampires are predators. They are attracted to the fight or flight response. And Matthew said that vampires don't always need to feed, but they always crave the hunt. Here's a little science that we learned, but we're going to get into the science of it all a little later. But vampires get an extra chromosome pair since they aren't born with it. And a vampire's DNA has mutations that result in disease resistance. Now let's move on to Ashmole 782. We have more information about this book and what vampires believe about it. Vampires believe that it explains their longevity and their strength. They feared that the book would fall into the wrong hands, a witch's hands, and it would lead to their extermination. Some vampires believe that magic was involved in their making and that witches would find a way to reverse it. And Matthew thinks that part of the legend is true. Diana also comes clean and she tells Matthew more about Ashmole 782. She said that the book Matthew is seeking is actually inside of Ashmole 782. It seems to be an alchemy book on the surface. The images contain errors or deliberate mistakes. And the book is a palimpsest, which is a manuscript or piece of writing material that has been reused or overwritten with new texts, often after the original text has been erased or partially erased. Diana also said that magic was hiding the text. She could see lines of writing moving underneath when she turned a page and light was at just the right angle, but she couldn't read it though. Now, when we were in Matthew's lab, there was talk about creatures dying out. Let's talk about that. So when Diana was in the lab, the newspaper articles about the vampire killings were brought up. And Matthew believed that these deaths were actually results of botched attempts to transform humans into vampires. There was also mention of how witches weren't as powerful as they once were, and they weren't producing as many children as they used to. It seems that creatures have felt the pressure of living in a world that is more human, so they are trying to hide who they truly are more. Also, the world used to be divided more evenly between humans and creatures. But now, humans are the majority and creatures only take up 10% of the world's population. So there is a lot of talk about science in this book. Now, I passed high school biology, but it was not my favorite class, which is actually interesting because the science in this book is one of the most intriguing things to me. So what Matthew, Miriam, and Marcus are doing in his lab, they are studying evolution. But the difference between their lab and the other labs is that they aren't just studying humans. They are also studying the genetics of vampires, witches, and demons. They are studying genome and mitochondrial DNA. The genome refers to the complete set of genetic material, DNA, present in an organism. It's like a massive instruction manual for life stored in DNA. It contains all the information needed to build and operate an organism, from genes that code for proteins to regions that control gene activity. Scientists study the genome to understand how genes work and contribute to traits and diseases. It's basically the code of life. Now, mitochondrial DNA is a small circular piece of DNA found within the mitochondria, which are tiny structures inside cells responsible for generating energy. It's inherited only from the mother and contains genes important for mitochondrial function. Scientists use it to trace maternal ancestry and study evolution, health, and diseases. And this is what Matthew is doing with it. He wants to use the mitochondrial DNA to help them understand the history of a whole species, to help them understand what is going on with the creatures and why they seem to be dying out. And we also learn the differences between the creatures scientifically. Humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes in every cell nucleus. Vampires and witches have 24. And we learned earlier that vampires get their 24th after they are turned. And demons also have 23 pairs like humans, but they have an extra single chromosome. Mm-hmm. Now, throughout this story, we will continue to see the mention of historical figures, and I'm going to continue to keep track of them. I don't think I've missed anyone during these chapters, but I might have. Let me know. First up, we have Machiavelli. He was mentioned when Diana was trying to figure out Matthew's age, asking if Matthew knew him. So Niccolo Machiavelli was an Italian Renaissance political philosopher and writer. He was best known for his seminal work, The Prince, which was written in 1513. He was called the founder of modern political science. He was also a senior official in the Florentine Republic in diplomatic and military affairs. His ideas on politics and leadership have sparked significant debates and controversy over the centuries, with some viewing him as a realist who understood the complexities of power dynamics, while others see him as a proponent of unethical behavior in politics. Next, we have Peter Abelard. He was also mentioned when Diana was trying to figure out Matthew's age. She wondered if Matthew attended the University of Paris when Abelard was teaching there. So Peter was a French philosopher, theologian, and logician. He lived in the 12th century, and he is best known for his work in logic and his contributions to medieval philosophy. His most famous work was Sic et Non. He looked at different ideas from church leaders to show why it's important to think critically about religion. He also had a well-known love story with a woman named Heloise. They wrote letters to each other known as the Letters of Abelard and Heloise, which talked about their intense and sad love. Next, we have Charlemagne. And like the ones before, he was mentioned when Diana was trying to figure out Matthew's age. She wanted to know if Matthew watched his coronation. So Charlemagne was a powerful king of the Franks in the early Middle Ages. He was a skilled military leader and expanded his kingdom through conquests, eventually uniting most of Western Europe under his rule. He supported Christianity, established schools, and was crowned Emperor of the Romans in 800 AD. Charlemagne is celebrated for his military achievements and contributions to European culture and education. Next, there is Ben Jonson. Diana thought of a line written by him when she found out Matthew's age. So Ben Jonson was a prominent English playwright and poet who lived during the late 16th and early 17th centuries. He is best known for his satirical comedies such as Vulpian and The Alchemist, which criticized the social and political issues of his time. And he was a contemporary of William Shakespeare and highly regarded for his wit and craftsmanship in writing. He also served as a literary critic and influenced the development of English drama. Next, we have John Milton. Matthew quoted him while speaking to Diana. So John was an influential English poet and writer who lived during the 17th century. He is best known for his epic poem, Paradise Lost, which tells the story of the fall of man and explores themes of good and evil, free will, and redemption. You know, I don't think I ever read Paradise Lost. I just thought about that. But Milton was also a political activist and wrote numerous pamphlets advocating for religious and political freedom. Or maybe I read it in high school or college. I don't know. Despite losing his sight later in life, Milton continued to write and produce significant works, including Paradise Regained and Sansum Agonistes. Next, we have Elizabeth Tudor. She was commonly known as Queen Elizabeth I and was one of England's most famous monarchs. She ruled from 1558 until her death in 1603, making her reign one of the longest in English history. She was a daughter of King Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, and her reign saw religious and political stability, defeating the Spanish Armada in 1588 and fostering a golden age of arts and exploration. And her intelligence and diplomacy earned her the nickname the Virgin Queen. Next, we have Marquis de Lafayette. So the Marquis de Lafayette, Gilbert de Mortier, was a French aristocrat who became a pivotal figure in both the American and French revolutions. Joining the Continental Army at just 19 years old, Lafayette formed a close bond with General George Washington and fought alongside American forces in key battles, including the decisive Battle of Yorktown. After the American Revolution, Lafayette returned to France and played a significant role in advocating for liberal reforms and supporting the ideals of the French Revolution. He helped draft the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen and remained a steadfast champion in liberty and democracy throughout his life. Next, we have Dr. Shippen. He was mentioned during the backstory of Marcus. Dr. William Shippen Jr. was a prominent American physician during the colonial era and early years of the United States. He is known for his significant contributions to medical education and practice in America. Shippen played a key role in founding the first medical school in the United States, the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. He served as the school's first professor of anatomy and surgery and was instrumental in establishing a formal medical curriculum based on scientific principles. Shippen's efforts helped to elevate the standards of medical education and practice in America, laying the foundation for the development of the country's medical profession. Next, we have John Cochran. He was also mentioned during the backstory on Marcus. Dr. John Cochran was a notable physician and military surgeon during the American Revolutionary War. He served as the Director General of the Continental Army's Medical Department from 1777 to 1781. Playing a crucial role in organizing medical care for American troops during the conflict. Cochran implemented reforms to improve hygiene and medical practices, reducing mortality rates among soldiers. He also established hospitals and medical facilities to provide care for wounded and sick soldiers. And next we have General Washington, who was also mentioned during Marcus's backstory. General George Washington. He was born in Virginia in 1732 and emerged as a pivotal figure in the American Revolutionary War and the founding of the United States. Appointed Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army in 1775, Washington led American forces throughout the conflict, facing numerous challenges and demonstrating exceptional leadership and strategic prowess. His victories, including the Battle of Trenton and the Siege of Yorktown, played a crucial role in securing American independence from British rule. After the war, Washington played a key role in shaping the new nation, presiding over the Constitutional Convention, and serving as the first president of the United States from 1789 to 1797. And of course, when I'm thinking about Lafayette and Washington, I'm thinking about the musical Hamilton. Next, we have the Oneida Warriors. They were also mentioned during Marcus's backstory. The Oneida were one of the six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, and their warriors played a significant role in various conflicts and alliances in colonial America. During the American Revolutionary War, the Oneida sided with the colonists and fought alongside them against the British. Oneida warriors participated in key battles, such as Oriskany and Saratoga, providing crucial support to the American cause. Their contributions helped to secure American victory and played a significant role in shaping the outcome of the war. And after the Revolutionary War, the Oneida continued to defend their homeland and way of life against encroaching settlers and government policies. And today, the Oneida Nation remain a federally recognized tribe with a rich cultural heritage and ongoing efforts to preserve the traditions and sovereignty. Next up, we have Charles Darwin. He was mentioned while Matthew was explaining what he was doing in 1859. Charles Darwin was a renowned British naturalist and biologist who is best known for his theory of evolution by natural selection. Born in 1809, Darwin embarked on a voyage aboard the HMS Beagle in 1831, during which he collected specimens and made observations that would later form the basis of his groundbreaking ideas. In 1859, Darwin published his seminal work, On the Origin of Species, in which he proposed that species evolve over time through the process of natural selection, whereby organisms with favorable traits are more likely to survive and reproduce. This theory revolutionized our understanding of the natural world and has had profound implications for fields such as biology, anthropology, and psychology. His work laid the foundation for modern evolutionary biology and continues to be a cornerstone of scientific inquiry. Next, we have Eleanor St. Leger. She was brought up as one of Matthew's past relationships. Eleanor was a historical figure known for her association with the Marquis de Lafayette, particularly in the context of the events surrounding her death. She was a woman from Ireland who became romantically involved with Lafayette's older brother, Baldwin. Their relationship was marked by tragedy when Baldwin and Eleanor were involved in a duel, resulting in Eleanor's death. The circumstances surrounding her life and death have captured historical interest, particularly due to her connection with the Lafayette family and the dramatic nature of the events. So reading her actual backstory makes me understand how she was kind of put into this story. Next, we have Attila. I believe Matthew mentioned him. I believe he did. So Attila, often referred to as Attila the Hun, was a powerful ruler and military leader of the Huns, a nomadic people originating from Central Asia. He reigned as king from 434 until his death in 453. Attila's leadership was characterized by his aggressive expansionist policies, leading the Huns in numerous military campaigns across Europe. He is perhaps best known for his invasion of the Western Roman Empire, during which he ravaged territories in modern-day France, Italy, and the Balkans. Attila's military prowess and ferocious reputation earned him the nickname Scourge of God. His death in 453 brought an end to his empire and marked the decline of the Hunnic threat to Europe. So we just went over a bunch of historical figures, but there seem to have been historical events mentioned during these chapters. So I'm going to start keeping track of them as well. Like historical figures, I don't think I've missed any events during these chapters, but I might have. Let me know. So we start off with Halley's Comet. This was named after the astronomer Edmund Halley, and it is one of the most famous comets known to humanity. It is visible from Earth approximately every 76 years as it orbits the Sun. Halley's Comet last made its appearance in the inner solar system in 1986 and is expected to return around the year 2061. Its appearance has been recorded throughout history with notable sightings in 1758 and 1835, among others. The comet's distinct tail, composed of dust and gas, makes it a spectacular sight in the night sky. It has been the subject of scientific study for centuries, providing valuable insights into the composition and behavior of comets. Next, we have the Fall of Carthage. So the Fall of Carthage, one of the most significant events in ancient history, marked the end of the powerful Phoenician city-state and its centuries-long rivalry with Rome. The Third Punic War from 149 to 146 BCE culminated in the siege and destruction of Carthage by Roman forces under the command of Scipio Aemilianus. The city's downfall was a result of long-standing enmity between Carthage and Rome, fueled by territorial disputes, economic competition, and political ambitions. After a three-year siege, Carthage fell to the Romans, who razed the city to the ground, enslaved its population, and salted the earth to prevent its resurgence. The fall of Carthage marked the end of Phoenician influence in the Mediterranean and solidified Rome's dominance as the preeminent power in the region. Next, we'll talk about Clovis converted to Christianity. This was mentioned when Matthew talked about when he was born, along with some of the other stuff I just talked about. The conversion of Clovis I, the first king to unite all the Frankish tribes to Christianity around 496 CE, Common Era, marked a pivotal moment in European history. Legend has it that his conversion followed his victory at the Battle of Tolbiac against the Alemanni tribe, attributing his success to the Christian God. The significant events not only aligned Clovis and the Frankish kingdom with the growing influence of Christianity in Europe, but also provided religious legitimacy to his rule. Clovis's conversion facilitated the spread of Christianity among the Frankish people and played a crucial role in the Christianization of Western Europe, shaping the religious and cultural landscape of the region for centuries to come. Next, we have the Black Death. I believe this was mentioned when Diana was trying to figure out how old Matthew was. So the same as the others. The Black Death, one of the deadliest pandemics in human history, swept across Europe and Asia in the 14th century, causing devastation on an unprecedented scale. Originating in Central Asia, the disease caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis spread rapidly along trade routes carried by fleas infesting rats. The plague arrived in Europe in 1347 and quickly spread, decimating populations and leading to widespread social, economic, and cultural upheaval. Symptoms of the Black Death included fever, chills, swollen lymph nodes, and the formation of painful bubbles. Estimates suggest that the Black Death killed between 75 to 200 million people, wiping out as much as 60% of Europe's population. Next up, we have Urban II Crusade. Pope Urban II's call for the First Crusade in 1095 marked the beginning of a series of military campaigns launched by Western European Christians to reclaim Jerusalem and other holy cities in the Eastern Mediterranean from Muslim control. Addressing a crowd at the Council of Clermont in France, Urban II urged Christians to take up arms and embark on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, promising spiritual rewards and the remission of sins to those who participated. The response to Urban II's call was overwhelming, with thousands of knights, soldiers, and commoners joining the crusade. The First Crusade culminated in the capture of Jerusalem in 1099, establishing several crusader states in the region. It sparked subsequent waves of crusades over the next two centuries, shaping the political, religious, and cultural landscape of medieval Europe and the Middle East. Okay, we added locations in the last episode, and there were a couple locations that were mentioned here. First up, we have All Souls College. So All Souls College was located in Oxford, England, and is one of the constituent colleges of the University of Oxford. It was founded in 1438 by Henry VI, All Souls is renowned for its academic excellence and prestigious fellowships. The college is distinctive for its distinctive neo-Gothic architecture, including the iconic Codrington Library. It is primarily dedicated to postgraduate research and scholarship, with fellows and scholars from diverse academic disciplines contributing to its intellectual community. Known for its rigorous selection process, All Souls maintains a tradition of academic excellence and scholarly pursuit, making it one of the most esteemed colleges within the University of Oxford. And then we have the Marlborough Club. So that was a prestigious social club founded in London in 1863. It was situated in Pall Mall, a street renowned for its exclusive clubs. The Marlborough Club catered to the elite of British society, offering its members luxurious facilities for dining, socializing, and recreation. It attracted members from aristocratic families, high-ranking military officers, politicians, and other influential figures. The club's elegant premises and impeccable service made it a favorite gathering place for the upper echelons of society during the Victorian era, and it eventually closed its doors in the early 20th century. Okay, so we'll move on to the rapid fire section now. To start, we'll discuss the three characters I want to talk about. And first up, we have Marcus Whitmore. He is one of my favorite characters. I was about to say that all of the vampires are my favorite characters, but no. That is not true. We'll get to the others that I do not like later on. But back to Marcus. He is Matthew's son, not biologically, but in vampire terms. We meet him first when we are in Matthew's lab. And later we get some backstory about him and his relationship with Matthew. So Marcus meets Matthew in 1777. He's actually American. He's from Hadley, Massachusetts. He was a surgeon's assistant in the Continental Army, and he was turned in 1781 after catching a fever. He also fathered his own children in New Orleans later on, and things got a bit out of hand there. Matthew, along with a vampire named Juliet, who we have not met yet, cleaned up that mess, which caused Marcus to have less children. And that's pretty much what we know about Marcus so far. We know that he cares for Matthew, he cares for his family, and he wants to make sure that Matthew doesn't get into any trouble. Next character I want to talk about is Miriam Shepherd, another one of my favorite characters, also a vampire. We met her earlier on when Matthew needed her to help protect Diana. And information about her and when she became a vampire is unknown as of now. And we actually have not learned much about her so far. But what we do know is that she is a close research colleague and friend to Matthew. She is a rather honest vampire. She seemed to tell Diana about herself quite a bit when she could. And she is very loyal to Matthew. She's a very loyal friend. And the last character I want to talk about is Sean. Now, I could not find a lot of information about Sean. I do not see him in the World of All Souls book, and they list all of the characters. And I also cannot tell you what his last name is, but I like Sean. And since I had mentioned a couple of the characters that I liked, why not end this section by mentioning another character that I like? So Sean works at the call desk at the Bodleian Library, and he is very nice to Diana. They are friends. They had shared drinks at the pub across the street from the Bodleian during their graduate student days. We also know that he is protective of Diana, and he wants to make sure that she isn't being bothered by Matthew. And that's about it. That's what we know about Sean. And I do wish we knew more. Okay, we just talked about the characters. Now let's talk about a couple things, two things I'm excited about coming up in the future. The first being the congregation. Who else is a member of the congregation? We know that Peter Knox is a member, but we do not know who else is. There are 9 members. So maybe we'll end up meeting one of them soon, or maybe more than one soon. The other thing is Septor. So we know that Matthew is taking Diana to Septor to keep her protected and away from Peter Knox. We'll get to meet Isabel. She is Matthew's mother, and she was mentioned by Marcus. Marcus isn't happy that Matthew is taking Diana to Septor. And he mentioned how Matthew can't put Diana and Isabel under the same roof. It seems that Isabel blames witches for the deaths of Philippe and Louisa. So that will be interesting for Diana to visit. And what else will we learn there? Okay, let's move on to favorite quotes. I had a few quotes here that I thought about mentioning. But the one that stood out to me was when Diana said, "Magic is desire made real." I really like this quote, and I like how we can use this in our own reality outside of the story. It could imply that a desire someone has could have the power to manifest into reality. And if that desire is strong enough, it can materialize for that person. But just have good thoughts when thinking about these desires, people. Leave the negativity out, because you'll never know what you might bring into this world. That brings us to the end of this episode into the world of the Discovery of Witches. We tackled chapters 12 through 16, and next week we will be reading chapters 17 through 22. So get ready for more adventures with Diana and Matthew, and hopefully a trip to Septor. I'd really love to hear your thoughts on what is going on in these chapters. You can send me an email to suchafunread@gmail.com. Also, if you'd like to send in a voicemail, we have a website now. You can go on over to suchafunread.com and click on the Join the Discussion button. I love to spotlight your thoughts in future episodes. And if you're enjoying this deep dive into the world of All Souls, please share with your friends. If you know someone that loves this series or could love this series, go ahead and share this episode with them, and then we can all love this series together. Also, don't forget to please consider rating and reviewing Such a Fun Read on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. As I mentioned earlier, every rating helps spread the word and allows more fans of this book to join our discussions and the community. Until next time, happy reading!